show.
Oh, you.
I didn't know what you would prefer. Please help yourself.
Oh, thank you. Don't listen to reason, right?
No, of course not. I'm Mediterranean, though. People tell us we're not hungry, we don't listen. We completely ignore that. You know, it's just like, yeah, okay, fine, eat.
You're so funny. Okay, you know what? Can I take a couple pictures?
Of course, yes, of course.
So Endless Red is a very in-your-face narrative depiction of my discontent with the world right now. And that's why, I mean, people say, oh, I'm seeing red, and I just thought of Endless Red. Of course, red as a color is very symbolic, but it's also the fact that I spent so much time mixing that specific red that I was trying to arrive at, that played a big role in the naming of the show. The main painting is a hybrid painting between Guernica, which I think is quite obvious in the painting, and the lesser obvious one is Massacre of the Innocents by Peter Paul Rubens. And in fact, the painting draws much more from the Rubens painting than it does from Guernica. And Guernica is the most epic, ultimate war painting. And so, of course, it's something that I've been obsessing over for years.
In what way? What about it? Is Picasso's Guernica?
Well, you know, it's really, if you think about it, it's actually a very effective piece because it's incredibly bold and graphic, and it's limited in tone. It's black, white, and gray. And it has this true Picasso cartoonish element, which at once makes it approachable, but then you realize what you're looking at. And all the symbolism that is behind the painting. But what fascinated me specifically about the painting, and that started about 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, are the hands. And so I have this book, War and Art, that I've been looking through, and I've been studying all these war paintings, but specifically the hands in these war paintings. And the idea is that if you really study these hands, you can tell a great deal about the person's, what the person is going through.
You mean the figure?
What the figure
or
is.
Or the artist.
The figure in the painting. So you can read the character of that figure when you study the hand. So if it's clenched or if it's open or if it's pointing or if it's stopping. So I thought, well, how nice that it communicates so much, and so you don't really always need to see the body. And so hands started surfacing more and more in my work. And, you know, the white glove is something that I've had in my paintings already since 2015, and that is a nod to my grandmother because it's my last memory of her. And so bringing that into the mix of these hands it's completes it for me, but it also is a new beginning with respect to avenues that I can explore, and sensing what the figure or even the artist is going through the depiction of the hand is a powerful entry point, I think. And so in that Endless Red painting, the Massacre of the Innocents as a reference is directly connected to President Trump and is a direct critique of him because I likened him to Herod killing all these newborns because of the border separation of these families from their kids, which as a mother and as a human being, I find completely unacceptable. And I don't care about the argument that that Homeland Security has been saying regarding the fact that these kids did not come with their parents, but are being used as entry point keys. I don't care about that. I think that it's completely unethical for us as a nation to behave in this manner. And so that is why I chose that specific painting as a reference.
The red.
Yes.
There are so many reds in the world.
Right. So I have the exact recipe. I'll pull out the book. It's basically, I have, this is my color book with all these detailed notes. And so this red is the red that's in the painting. And basically, it's all of these plus this. And so I also write down the brand. So for example, here we have Golden Brand, Van Dyke Brown, Liquitex Unbleached Titanium. And then, of course, I specify if I use latex house paint and which brand, like Behr or another brand. And then, of course, it's quite detailed. And I kind of know the proportion, so I don't write that mm-hmm, down. Mm-hmm. And it's quite an unexpected. Quite unexpected to arrive at this kind of recipe, because as you can see, there's some green in there as well, which I always knew was going to be in the mix. But it took a while to arrive at this.
Sure. Let's see. The white. Is that noted?
So, let's see. We do have unbleached titanium. And no, actually, I do not have any white in here at all in that mix. So the unbleached titanium is kind of the white stand-in to lighten the color, but no white.
You know how people read colors like a recipe, right?
Yes, absolutely.
It's so cool.
Absolutely.
Do you have your students do this too?
Oh, extensively. I mean, we have color charts that
are really
detailed. And it's, at first, they think it's a little onerous, but actually they totally get it and enjoy it, and they become a little obsessive with how they mix the color. And really, when you teach students to mix color at such a complex level, it's a game changer for painters. It's really a game changer, because not only do they learn how to harmonize the colors, but they also mix unusual colors that, I mean, that's what you want as a painter. You want people to come and see your work and think, oh my goodness, I wonder what color this is. This is so beautiful. And I mean, that's not the only thing you want, but it's definitely one of the things that you want.
When I say we look at it like a recipe, I mean, of course it's like a recipe, this, that, and that, but we read it with sensations attached to the words. I mean, so when you're having students mix colors that involve more than two, mix more than two colors together, they're going for something and they're learning the variables.
Absolutely. So there's this one exercise that I have them do, and it's called the autobiographical color chart. And I got the idea from Jim Dine, who had these beautiful color swatch paintings, mm-hmm. and he described them as highly autobiographical. And I thought, well, that would be an interesting exercise to have students do, where they are mixing these charts where each color is representative of either a memory, so it can be a memory trigger, or it's representative of something that they like or something that disturbs them, or it's just the way for them to get to know not only a little bit more about who they are, but also their own color preferences. And so the first thing I have them do is go to the hardware store and get color swatches. And the swatches have to be either colors that they respond to or memory triggers. And then they bring them back to the classroom. And the first thing that I have them do is what I call, and this is not an official term, it's something I made up, something called a mother mix. So the mother mix that I have them make is a neutral that is mixing friendly. And it's made up of about five colors. And then they mix a dark version and a light version of this mother mix.
And it's a mix of five colors. It can be actually a preponderance of any color they want.
Well, as long as
what does
as
it look it, like?
As long as it's neutral.
Neutral.
So it ends up, and a means neutral can be, can have gray tones, it can have brown tones, it can have blue or red tones, but really it's mixing friendly. And so it's at this place where it's not quite a gray, but it's a nice mid kind of gray.
Oh, do they start with white?
Well, there is a white. In the demo that I do for them, I always use a white. Certainly when they're making the light version, they add more white to it. So yes, there is a little bit of white. Now, I've seen students do mother mixes with no white at all. One of them is Yumiko Glover, and so she has a really interesting set of color mix, mother mixes too. And so so basically from that, they use that as a starting point. Step two is to color match to the color swatches. But every time before they apply, they have to borrow a little bit from the mother mix. Now, it's very critical that you don't add too much because it will completely neutralize the color. So a little tiny bit goes a long way. And then this mother mix is actually, it acts kind of like a spice that connects all the flavors together. And I always tell my students, it's like you're cooking chicken and you add spice. You don't change the chicken. Chicken's still chicken, but but there's added flavor to it. And the mother mix should behave the same way. Uh-huh. And if they add too much of the neutral, then it will kill the color. So the job of the mother mix is not to compromise the color, but it's to help colors communicate across the board.
That is really interesting. Mm-hmm. It sounds like it would almost guarantee you results a notch above the average first project.
It's foolproof. It's absolutely foolproof. And, I have to thank my professor from grad school, Tom Brown, who was trying to convince me to take a color theory class. And I, being the stubborn person that I am, said that I didn't want to because it took so much time away from the studio. So he said, okay, fine, then you have to come up with your own color mixing method. You have to really get to know color. And that's what I did. I spent 2-3 weeks in the studio mixing and mixing and mixing color, and I came up with this mother mix system. And then I shared my findings with him. And I remember him saying that this was what he was hoping I would discover. And so
why is it a commonly known technique or method or something?
Not that I know of. At least it's never been labeled, but I think the idea of mixing a neutral is not that unusual, but for me to label it this way and to actually make it so, I am not only mixing five colors to create a neutral, but when you're mixing the actual color, you really want to have at least four or five different mixes per color. And so add that to the original mother mix, and you have 10 colors per color swatch. Mm. And that's amazing. It's really sophisticated. But as a precursor to that, actually, what my beginning students have to do is mix an extensive color chart that I have come up with myself. And it's recipes of color that end up being really unusual and surprising when you mix them together. So as a first step, you're mixing, let's say, a cobalt blue plus a viridian plus a white. Or, for example, it's a viridian plus a burnt umber plus a white. And then, of course, they have to start with a 50-50 mix, and then I have them do 75-25 and vice versa. And then they mix the original 50 with 50% white. And they end up with these four swatches of color that are really surprising. I mean, oftentimes when we're starting to work with a still life, they refer very heavily to these charts because it helps them color match, or at least gives them a starting point.
And you're amazing me. This is really giving people, a leg up on starting a painting.
Well, so, you know, I don't approach beginning painting like it's traditionally taught in colleges. I've completely designed my own course because I felt like I had to make it relevant and accessible. And so a lot of painting classes start with a black and white still life, then a white and umber still life, and it's just slowly build them up. I start with the color chart. They mix the color chart, and then we move on to a still life right away in full color. And we do a couple of those, and then we do the autobiographical color chart. And then towards the final, they are using both local and non-local color. And they're making decisions on non-local color. And
what
we're
do you
working
mean by that?
So local color is the color that you see in the still life, and you mix and you match that. But non-local color definitely is an arbitrary choice of color based on personal preference. And so with the knowledge of the mother mix and with the knowledge of their own personal color palette, when they start making decisions using non-local color, what they're doing is they are beginning to build paintings that are that have a personal color palette, that has a palette that is unique to them. And so, you know, if you look at Kainoa Grusby's work, for example, I mean, he has a very specific set of colors that he uses. Or Tommy Height, for example, also a very specific color set that he uses that is so uniquely him. And I feel that...
They went through your classes.
Yeah, they both did, yes. And I feel like they have come to the point where they know themselves, to the point where they make very, very deliberate color decisions. And this is not... What we do as painters is not coloring. It's not sofa decoration. It's not decoration, period. It's a lot of research. It's a life of research and study. And that's what makes it so exciting. I mean, I'm often asked, well, how do you have the motivation to go to the studio? You're so busy all the time. And for me, this is a lifeline, and I can't wait to get to the studio, because there's so much work to do. I mean, I have ideas that will fuel me until the day I die. And you really want to be immersed in that level of research.
I know that some people sit down and just think, oh gosh, I don't know what to paint. But when you go at it with some tools where you can actually address something personal, I think it gives you really something to work with, something that you want to work with.
Yeah, and, you know, my professor in grad school would always say there's no such thing as artist block. And I would debate with him, and he would say, just do anything if you're feeling stuck. Just do anything. Pick up a camera, go outside, take pictures. And, of course, now I completely understand and appreciate that, because no matter where you're at, there's always something to do. The goal is to get yourself to a point where everything is a resource. Everything is fueling and motivating. And you're just so seduced by life around you. Everything. I mean, you know, I'm driving and I look at the trees and the negative shapes and the way the shadow is cast. There's so much to see. And so I completely agree with that idea that there's no such thing as being at a loss with respect to what to do. And
why does that give you something to do?
Well, because, you know, I'm a big believer in that the best ideas come from working in the studio. So in other words, you don't wait for inspiration to hit you. You work in the studio, and then these ideas start falling into place. And it could be that you're working on something that has absolutely nothing to do with what you ultimately become, but a certain mark, a certain color, it's all a way of getting to know who you are as a person and as an artist. That will all fuel you until you get to that stage where you're absolutely sure that this is my mission as an artist.
Help me with this one. You know, it's about trying to say something with your art. Mm-hmm. You know, how do you work with something like that without getting the thing to look programmatic?
You mean in terms of Endless Red, or
let's say in terms of Endless Red, yeah. Mm-hmm. Your general message there,
right,
was.
So the general message, of course, is my discontent or my rage with with the political situation, both in the Middle East and in the U.S. But you may have it all planned out in your head, but the minute you start working on the surface also has other ideas. And so the image may or may not turn out the way you had preconceived it. And more often than not, if you're really being true to the process and in touch with the process, you end up with something that deviates very far from your original thought. And you have to have that openness, and you have to have that that listening ear towards the what the painting needs and what it's telling you that should happen on the surface. And that's the dialogue that all artists wait for.
Does this say what I meant to say?
Well, sometimes it surprises you and it says something more. And that's the best possible scenario. I always talk about the practice of painting as the unspoken. It really is an unspoken practice. It can't be put to words. Because when we are working on a painting, we are tapping into different levels of ourselves, and all of those combine and culminate in the mark on the painting. And so when you are working on a painting, you have to consider your energy on any given day, the force of the mark, the meaning of the mark, how it's sitting. I mean, in other words, the marks cannot be arbitrary. The colors, the surface, the message, the drawing, the composition. So there are so many different, and the idea is just one aspect of that. And so the best possible case is when all of these are in agreement. And they come, you know, because sometimes the mark is doing something counter to the idea.
And of course, you love it. It looks great.
But you love it. It looks great. But you have to let it go. You have to let it go. Like Jim Dine says that sometimes you have to send a drawing to its death in order to give it new life. And so you have to, absolutely have to let it go in pursuit of a higher image. The artist John Virtues talks about the element of risk. He always says, if you're not risking it, you're not cooking with gas.
You mean if you're not risking taking it off?
Exactly. And he said, sometimes, you know, you end up with a worthy second best. And it's easy to stop at that, but you shouldn't. You should just absolutely risk it and possibly lose this second best in pursuit of the best.
So for months, hours, days, you're acting and then stepping back and seeing. You're acting and then stepping back. How do you know when to stop?
That's always interesting. Sometimes when I don't know, I put the painting away for a while and I revisit it. One of the paintings that I had in a group show at Peggy Hopper Gallery a couple of years ago, it took me 10 years to finish that painting. And so it came back and was...
That painting.
Yeah, it came back and it was destroyed so many times. And finally, it resolved itself. And sometimes you just know it's time. You know because you fully believe and understand that you've given it absolutely everything that you have. You've given it 100%, and there's no going further within your current intellectual capabilities. And perhaps in another 10 years you can see another future for the painting. But at the moment, there's no going further. You've reached the edge of the cliff, and that's it.
Mm-hmm. Just loved. Thank you so much for this.
Oh my gosh, thank you. It's a pleasure to talk about painting on such a level. It's rejuvenating, and it's so important, and it's just so necessary that people understand that painting is not coloring. Painting is so much more than that, and it is really a lifelong pursuit.
I talked to recently to some people out in Kona. You know, I just wake up every morning and I just do what I feel, and it's great.
Well, I have issues with that statement because in the description of that, it's actually a very recreational activity, and it's a form of comfort. Painting is not comforting. That's not to say that you don't reach a certain catharsis at the end of a piece, but it's not meant to be therapy, in a sense. And it's, in fact, you have to push the boundaries of what is comfortable and, in fact, venture very deep into the forest of the unknown. It's necessary. Otherwise, there's no breakthrough that happens, and there's no new discovery. So moribund outlivers in the show that accompany Endless Red, those specific portraits are perhaps the hardest thing I've ever done. And I call them moribund because they depict these creatures that are nearing death, in a way, emotionally. And And I call them creatures because I think that survivors of war don't survive fully intact as humans. And so I feel like creatures is more appropriate a term.
You're a survivor of war.
Pardon?
You're a survivor of war.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I wouldn't put that label on anyone if I had not been one of them, because that would be presumptuous and insensitive. But I feel like I was trying to capture a portrait, not through the traditional method of painting a portrait, but rather having to have a portrait emerge out of a series of marks that convey the hysteria and the psychological state of the survivor, the war survivor, and just that energy that it takes to tap into that hysteria that will enable you to make a mark that is honest is exhausting. And I've been working on the series for 4 years now, and I've only finished about 11 pieces. It's a very, very tough series to work on. I mean, not to mention that I don't often want to get into that state of mind. So there's something that I go back to in between paintings, but not on a regular basis. So when someone says that painting when they describe it in such a recreational manner, I think that people have to do what they need to do for themselves. But in fact, that would be far more irritating and frustrating for me than arriving at the truth and finding out what that is through paint.
I know what you mean.
yeah, it's very hard. It's very hard. I mean, the thing that we do, and paint as a material has its own ideas. The physicality of the paint. I love it every once in a while when someone says painting is dead, and they've been saying that for years and years. It sounds so ignorant to me when that is said, because it's obvious that they haven't tapped into the potential of paint. And so there's a lot to be done. I've been painting for 23 years now, and I'm still a beginner. And that's, again, the exciting part about it. It's a sacred practice. It really is.
This is how you inspire those students.
With the sermons. You know, I do a lot of reading on theory and contemporary theory and politics, and just, you know, I think that's really important if you're a teacher, because you have to bring all these ideas into the classroom. Now, the reading part itself is not the big thing, but it's making associations that are relevant to these students and their projects. That's the part that takes training to arrive at. And so I feel like in so many ways I'm having... this year was a fantastic year. I'm having a great time because I feel like I've matured as a teacher. And I keep thinking of the writer Marguerite Yourcenar, where she says that there are certain books that you can't write until after you turn 40. And I feel very much the same, that there are certain... ideas that you can't share with students until you've reached 40 and you have the experience of time as a teacher and as a painter, to bring that into the classroom.
Yeah. You all have a pretty nice thing going out there at Leeward.
Yes, I'm very, very, very lucky. I not only have an amazing cast of co-workers that I work with, I mean, the collegiality, the camaraderie mm-hmm. is amazing, very stimulating. My co-worker, Michael Harada, and my other co-worker, Erica Molyneux, and I have this pen pal thing via text that we do every week where we send each other images of what we're working on. And Leeward itself is such a nice place to work at. Everything that I need for the classroom, for the students, is provided for me. And I'm just really enjoying it very much.
Those are the very students we want you to get at.
Yes. Well, you know, I mean, there's a certain sense of feeling that when you're teaching community college, there's something noble about that. And you're connecting to the students who need that kind of motivation. Yesterday, one of my students was joking with me that she senses me even when I'm not that close, and she says, "But it's a good thing. It's a good kind of hovering because I know that you care." And I always forget that a lot of these students, it's really important for them to know that the teacher cares. And, you know, I mean, I'm quite strict in my classes. I'm strict about attendance and being in class on time. And even though these kids are at the college level, but I feel like these kids want the to be held accountable. And because to them it's a sign that I care about their success and I care about them. And so I'm very, very mom about it all. So it works out.
Yeah, it's a good way to go at it, right?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no way you can get a certain caliber of work out of students unless they're there and they're on time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But, you know, and the second hardest thing is to somehow get past the surface level exercises and get them to something they want to start saying themselves.
Absolutely. You know?
And it sounds like you've got a couple of techniques.
Well, you get them to survive beginning drawing, and then it's smooth sailing from there. Beginning drawing is by far the hardest in terms of homework and just getting past the frustration of learning how to cite and do tone and all the formal elements. But I did find one thing to be especially helpful, and that is if you break up the classroom into groups or into pairs, the students into pairs, from very early on, and I call them accountability partners. So they're with the same partner for about a week, and they check in, and they give each other feedback, and they ask each other questions about the work, because sometimes a student is struggling, mm-hmm. but they don't want to ask me. And so in that setting, it's easier. So that builds a nice sense of camaraderie among the students themselves. And I found that when I've done these exercises with students, the classroom develops at the same time and as a group. And so everybody knows everybody else's name, and everybody knows...
Do they change partners?
They do.
Oh.
They do change partners. And so they get to know each other really well, mm-hmm. And they hold each other accountable. And so that solves an attendance problem. I have almost no absences in my beginning class at all, and so that helps a lot.
Well, that's amazing.
Are you?
Well, you know, it's a two-way thing. If you give them a lot, they'll give you a lot back. So that's what it is. Art is a very important way for people to be heard. And a lot of these students at community college have not been heard up until this point. And so it's important to give them that that avenue to explore who they are and to give them permission to express an aspect of who they are. And it's not that anything goes, right? This is not, again, this is not art therapy. But through a lot of foundation and structured exercises, there is a way to get very in-depth with respect to who you are as a human being and to be heard. And I think that's what keeps them coming back.
At a certain point, it requires an educated viewer so that you can really know what this person is saying.
Right. You know, I one of the classes I love teaching is Art 101. And this semester, I had a group of students that I took to the Honolulu Museum of Art, and we saw the biennial pieces that were there. And one of my students just walked up to me and he said, "This is not at all what I expected." And I thought it was a negative thing, but he actually meant it in a really good way. He said, "This is just really very cool. And I just thought we were going to look at a bunch of old paintings, but this is not what we're seeing." I mean, you just plant a seed in these students who are not art students, but they have to take this class as a requirement. Hopefully you have them develop an interest enough to come back to the museum or to support the arts or, I don't know, purchase a painting at one point. It is a vicious cycle because artists can't survive without supporters. And oftentimes those who can afford painting are not the people that you want to have your paintings. So, yeah. Drawing is the root for everything. I think it's the starting point for everything. All of those powwow artists, they learned the fundamentals. They know how to mix color. So a formal education can give you a lot of options. And so if this is what you're interested in doing, that's great. But you need the foundations. Something that's becoming increasingly hard among students today, especially with access to everything at their fingertips through the phone, they don't know how to wait. And so they want to be good, and they want to be good now, right? And so it takes them a while to get over themselves and to understand. Because it's funny, because they say, "Oh, how did you do that? You make it look so easy." And I look at them and I say, "I've been doing this for 23 years. Of course it's easy. I've been doing this for a while." Or if I mix a color and I match it exactly to what I'm seeing, they're always surprised. And I say, "You should be worried if I don't know how to do this," you know. But it takes so much to get to that point. And I don't know what they think this whole art thing is. But they are very quickly awakened in my class.